This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Have you ever really taken the time to listen to a rock or a leaf or even a coconut? Well, the artist Duncan Lurie has. He has spent years of his career exploring the sonic energy of everyday objects, and he's bringing some of those sounds to Raleigh. His work is part of a new exhibit at the Gregg Museum for Art and Design. The collection, Far-Fetched, Mad Science, Fringe Architecture, and Visionary Engineering, is going to be on display until April 26th. Duncan Lurie is an artist, a researcher, and the author of The Secret Art, A Brief History of Radionic Technology for the Creative Individual, and he joins us today. Welcome to the show, Duncan Lurie. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much. Pleasure.
Tell us about how you got interested in this sort of thing, the sound of things that we don't normally associate with having sound.
Well, I was looking for an experience of subtle energy. How could you find subtle energy in the environment? It's talked about, it's written about, people think about it. We explored it in terms of technology, and I wanted to find out if there was actually something real that we could examine and experiment with. And really the closest thing to that scientifically was experiments that were done by a man named Clive Baxter with plants back probably in the 60s and 70s that appear in a book called The Secret Life of Plants. Mm-hmm. So that seemed like a good place to start because there was already a history of this material in place.
So is this a little bit like, look, all stuff vibrates and vibration creates sound. And so, you know, one level or another, we ought to be able to intuit, hear, feel, be influenced by that kind of motion.
Well, the sonic part of it is very important because with the small voltages that are on the surface of plants and on certain rocks, you can extrapolate into pitch shifts. And from pitch shifts, they can become processed with computers and with algorithms into far more complicated sounds. So what you have is the potential to use nature in its exact form as a leaf, for instance, to become a musical co-composer.
So we have one. Well, we have an example, I think, of one of the compositions that you've made. This is a recording of a plant. Let's listen. Duncan Lurie is with me, that composition, part of an exhibit at the Gregg Museum for Art and Design. Tell us, what's going on there?
Well, essentially what takes place is you have a source, and the source is capable of really generating signals out of its own volition. You don't know why the plant is creating voltages on the leaf, but you know that they're moving around, they're active, they're potentially even intelligent. So why not take those sources and insert them into a composition? What my effort was to try to find a way to do that and then interest especially electronic musicians in that process to be able to use in their own work.
And so is this – well, finish that thought, please.
Well, what you heard there was probably a composition by – some people that may have visited me and who were already doing electronic music. We do it ourselves, but there are other people who do it much better.
And you had an experience as well while watching a Hopi rain dance. Did this inform some of what you do? And tell us about that.
Okay, that was at the beginning of my interest in this artistically. I had spent some time in the 1970s out in the Southwest, and one afternoon I was at a Hopi rain dance, probably the kind where they held the snakes, and it was very dramatic. But what was even more dramatic was just following the dance, thunderclouds rolled in, and by the time I got to my car, it was pouring rain. This was not a usual occurrence in that part of the world. So the connection between the dance being for rain and the actual rain coming so soon after led to the obvious assumption that there was a technology involved in the art that produced the rain.
When it comes to your compositions, is this possible with the old analog technology, or do you need digital technology to make these transformations of small voltages into sound that we can hear?
Oh, I don't think the technology really has much to do with it in terms of the sound composition. You can use anything you want to use. There's a part of this which is readily understandable, which is the audio production, the computer algorithmic side of it. And then there's a part of it that's not very well understood, and that's the intent. That's what does the plant or the source bring to the composition that's potentially outside the bounds of our understanding? That's the part that's very hard to explore.
When you pick up this sound, do you try to understand the intention of the plant, or do you let it sort of wash over you and let the plant think what it wants and then begin your creative process?
Well, I worked for 10 years with an electronics engineer named Gordon Salisbury, who was quite a skeptic, and that was a good thing. We looked at every aspect of this we could, both experimentally in terms of the procedures, were they fallible, what were the anomalies? Were the anomalies repeatable? Were there things that were so mysterious that they were just became astounding? I think that in Gordon's case, he started out very skeptical, and just through many years of looking at a lot of very interesting things take place, he became more convinced there was a lot more to this than just strict electromagnetic propagation.
Yeah, but it's just interesting to think about. I mean, the idea that we're influenced by these subtle forces and these subtle communications, if you will, vibrations, is not far-fetched at all, it seems to me. The question is what happens when we try to then sort of filter it and make it rational. We try to make sense of it. In other words, it's having its impact on us. It may be an impetus in one direction or other. And then we try to think about it, and you sort of wonder what happens in translation, I guess.
Yeah, every time we try to control a phenomena or grasp a phenomena, or we say, wow, look what happened, let's do it again, it would disappear. It was ephemeral. It had a quality of mystery to it that resisted appropriation. And it was best expressed by an Indian shaman I once met, who said, the spirit is shy. So there's a feeling that to these things that you can't really have them for yourself. They're something you might get as a gift, but you can never own them.
So tell us what happens at the exhibit. What do we experience, and what's it going to be like for us?
Well, the exhibit is a broad-based collection of all types of outsider art, and a few people like myself have had a little more training. But really, it's about what's been missed in the art world. These are artists that have gone under the radar. They're visionaries. They're eccentrics. They're outcasts. They're people that are beyond the normal classifications. So what I tried to do was bring an element into that mix which had to do with technology and an interest in technology that also has been missed, and ideas that were under the radar of science and basically ignored or ridiculed. So when you take these things and you put them into an artistic context, it's much more forgiving. You have more willingness to look at things that are outside the spectrum of everyday assumption. So this is what the show does. It introduces us to these things. And my contribution to it was simply to add a technological ingredient. And that's why I'm here.
And that is the purr generator, is it not?
Yes, that's true.
So what does that do? Tell us about the experience and the effect.
All right. The purr generator, as it exists in the show today, was the creation of myself, my engineer, Gordon Salisbury, and a VJ named Todd Thill, who we also collaborate with a lot in our projects. So we got together. We had a device which has an interesting history, and it has been continually redeveloped and rehacked and rebuilt for every circumstance that we have found an opportunity to do so. So when Roger Manley brought the device to North Carolina and put it in the Gregg, he decided he would like to see if we could actually hack this while we were down here and bring some new component to it. And that's why it's there.
What does it do? What happens when I get there?
Well, you get into you see a big structure. It's a cube octahedron made of aluminum pipe. It's almost 5.5 feet tall, and it has a bed inside of it. And you go lay down on the bed. Prior to laying down on the bed, there's a box, and the box has an input well in it. And you, just like you would toss a coin in a fountain and make a wish, you write a wish on a piece of paper, and you put it into the input well. And that now you climb up a short set of stairs, you lay down on the bed, and you push a button. And when you push the button, all of a sudden you're surrounded with the sounds of a cat's purr, the purring of a cat. You get in, you feel this thing. And what the idea is that if you have a wish and you want it, well, you're probably not going to get it. But if you have a wish and you just sit down and relax, then maybe your subconscious will enable you to provide you with that, the fulfillment of that wish. So that's the idea behind
it. A little bit
the
about
prayer.
The concept of prayer doesn't change God so much as it changes you if you find yourself
exactly
in that. Why a purr? Why a kitty cat? And don't I need the soft furry touch of the cat to go with the purr?
Well, that would be nice, but they're a little unmanageable in art exhibits. But,
and anywhere else.
Yeah. Yeah.
But why the purr?
Well, the purr was the brainchild of Gordon, my engineering friend. He had read and discovered that the purr frequencies actually facilitate bone curing, that there's a healing process out of these are all in the neighborhood of about 25 cycles per second, and there's a mixture of frequencies. It's not just one sound that you get from a cat. It's all over the place. And they are very relaxing, and they stimulate people to just let go. I mean, people have cats, and they hold them, and they walk with them, and it gives them security. So we thought that by incorporating the purr frequencies into the device, that we would then enable a person to have a joyful few moments on the bed.
And anybody who goes to the exhibit can experience this right now.
Exactly. They can get right in it.
Tell me about the something else you're involved in, something called the Mind Meld Retreat. What is that?
The Mind Meld was the invention of an electronic musician friend named Steve Nalepa. And he and I met through Paul Loffley, who's one of the artists in the show. And he had come to my studio in Rhode Island and had seen all this technology, and a lot of it which was acoustic. And he said he really wanted to invite friends to participate in this and to see if they could take some of the sounds and use some of the technology in their own work. So he informally started bringing people in, and this sort of became an event over a few years, and we would just hang around and have fun and experiment and then go out and do a performance somewhere. So this just became more informal. It's not an event for the public.
Well, I can see the way this works well in the world of music. I can also imagine you and in a divinity school with a research lab and having scientists and div majors get together and talk over some of your concepts. Is the world of science and research interested in what you're doing?
Not to my knowledge.
I mean, a lot of what you're doing is based on some research. The cat frequency, for instance, there has been some actual data that's generated scientifically on.
I'll tell you where the overlap takes place, although I'm not part of it. It's in the placebo study. If you look at alternative health cures, I mean, most of the medical laboratories that are developing medicines for common use have a placebo study to compare their medicines to. Well, the question is why does 25% of the placebos work consistently? What is going on? It can hardly be random if it's working all the time. So somewhere in this transaction, the mind is engaging the doctor's intent, whatever is taking place is causing 25% of the people to get better, sometimes more, complicated diseases. So that's an example where science, by virtue of necessity to make their own proofs, has had to look at even dimly at these other alternatives that are out there.
And what about in the world of music? Are musicians, and can they become intentional about what you're finding and add it to their music to greater effect?
Well, I think there is already what they call subliminals that does this. I don't know a lot about that. What I'm really talking about is artists using this in a conscious way with a conscious source, like a plant, as a co-creator. That's my idea, is that if there is such a thing as nature intelligence, if there is something like this that is willing to interface with man and contribute to his well-being, then I think probably artists are the people that are going to find it and use it.
Duncan, thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Duncan Lorre is an artist, researcher, and author of The Secret Art, A Brief History of Radionic Technology for the Creative Individual. The exhibit, Far-Fetched Mad Science, Fringe Architecture, and Visionary Engineering, is on display until April 26th at the Gregg Museum for Art and Design at North Carolina State University. Thanks for listening to The State of Things. Our program is directed by Alex Granados, produced by Sean Wen, Nicole Campbell, and Dave DeWitt. Christina Blyde is our intern, Robin Copley, the technical director, Brent Wolf, our news director, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.